As we saw last time, as Peter introduced a new series for such a time as this to us, looking at the book of Esther in the Old Testament, he was telling us that this book, and amongst all of the literature in the Old Testament, is a unique book. It's unique in that it makes no mention of God. His name does not appear in Esther even once. And that is unlike all the other books that we find in the Old Testament, and perhaps except for Song of Solomon, except the Hebrew does some stuff that plays around with it so that you do hear Elohim if you read it right. But Esther doesn't mention it at all. And yet, despite this, the book of Esther serves to reassure God's people who were living outside of the land of Jerusalem, the promised land, and the land of Israel, that the Lord, even when his people are far away, is still working. He's still working even when he is unseen. He is still working even when he is unmentioned. In chapter 1, we saw how a personal dispute became a national crisis which affected the entire empire. But we were reminded that even when foolish actions are taken by a godless king, even then the Lord is in control. As we turn now to chapter 2 of Esther, we continue to see the effects, the ripples of King Ahasuerus's actions on the nation. But this time we also see how his actions not only affect the whole empire, everyone living in it, but the specific lives of two of God's people remaining in Persia. Now let me give just a brief warning about this chapter. This chapter in the book of Esther is not as you remember your Sunday school teachers teaching it. We see God's people being put in a situation that no believer would ever have any desire to be put into. And unlike other books where the characters within them set in Babylonian or Persian exile experienced the miraculous hand of God coming and rescuing them from certain horrible and terrible events, we see no miracle. And so in Esther, we need to look more carefully. Because remember, God is working even when he's unmentioned. And as we do this, what we see is not his miraculous, extraordinary providence, but we see God working in the ordinary providence of people's lives. And we're going to see that in three ways. We'll see, firstly, God's providence in the places we live. God's providence in the places we live. And this is verses 1 to 7. So the events of Esther 2, they happen approximately 3 years after he has deposed of Vashti as his queen. If we're reading too quickly, we can get this idea that this happened, then immediately that happened, and there is a gap. And what's happened in the gap? Well, history informs us that during this time, Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, had unsuccessfully attempted to conquer the Greeks. He came home with egg on his face. It was a humiliating defeat that continued to be remembered for generations to come and written in the history books, making him look very weak. And so, having failed in matters abroad, he turns his mind back to matters at home. And we see in verse 1 his sorrow. The narrator tells us that Ahasuerus, he remembered what Vashti had done in the years previous. Notice, though, he takes no responsibility for his own actions. He remembers what she had done when she had refused to come into his court drunken feast wearing a crown. Sorry, Frank?
Bacchanale.
That one, yeah. And he had wanted to show off his wife, demeaning her dignity, devaluing her as a woman made in the image of God. And she had refused. That's what she had done. She had refused. But he remembers what Vashti had done. Husbands, take responsibilities for your sinful actions, won't you? Don't blame your wives. He now seems, however, to remember her in the sense that he regrets listening to his advisers who told him to remove the crown from her. And he also knows that the law of the Medes and the Persians is unalterable. Once it has been written, it cannot be reversed. And so he is sorrowful. He seems upset by this whole situation. But you know, when the Bible tells us that God remembers something, we usually see him about to act. When God remembered Noah, he then commanded him to come off the ark. When God remembers his promises, he does something. When God remembered his covenant to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he came to the rescue of Israel in Egypt. When Ahasuerus remembers something, he runs to his advisors so that they would tell him what to do. He is a far cry from being in control. He's a far cry from the true sovereign who is God over all. And so he goes back to his best advisors, and now we see his search throughout the empire in verses 2 to 7. His counselors tell him that he must host a contest so that they may find for him a new king that is a new queen, that is pleasing to him. What are the qualifications for this contest for entry? Well, the qualifications are that they must be 1, beautiful, 2, young, and 3, virgins. That's the qualifications. Here is his standard. A wife doesn't need to have a beautiful character, she just has to have a beautiful appearance. I don't want her to be aged, I want her to be old, I want her to be young. You see, his whole concept of the opposite sex, his whole view and perspective of the opposite sex would fit nicely into our modern world today, but it is completely contrary to God's law. You see, far better if he had focused on the inner beauty of a woman. So the search takes place in every province of the empire, including the city, the citadel of Susa. This is the main capital of the Persian Empire. This is the place where the royal palace is. This is the administrative powerhouse of Persia. And in Susa, which also, by the way, makes the whole contest look a bit foolish that it's going throughout the whole province, because the winner is right there on his doorstep. A young, beautiful woman called Hadassah. Well, that's her Jewish name. Esther is her Persian name, her Babylonian name perhaps. And she's living with her cousin Mordecai, and Mordecai has adopted her because she was an orphan. Her parents had died when she was young, and her cousin, being much older than her, had taken her in. You see, the Persian would call this a coincidence that Esther's there in that place at that time. But it seems, and it will become clearer, that Mordecai knows better. That this is no coincidence. This is the hidden hand of God at work. But the question is this: what were Mordecai and Esther doing in Susa? for clarity, it had been around 60 years since the Persian king Cyrus had decreed that the Jews could return home. Mordecai and Esther, what are you doing in Susa? You could go home. There are some, and I have to admit that coming into this series, I was leaning more towards this side of people who would take a dim view of Esther and Mordecai for not going home. But then I thought about it a little bit more and looked at the text a little bit more closely. And I don't think we should jump to judgment. Because after all, though they were not Persian ethnically, they certainly hadn't lived anywhere else. They had never seen Jerusalem. They had never seen the homeland of Israel. Mordecai and Esther were born into the Persian or Babylonian cultures. And the prophet Jeremiah, when speaking to the people when they were going into exile, had said to them, lay down roots. And why should they lay down roots? Well, because your exile is not going to be short. And what you need to do is you need to give your sons in marriage and your daughters in marriage, and you need to do business and live your lives, because this is, you're going to be here for some time. And so I think we need to be sympathetic to them. Because would you be quick to leave the only place you've ever lived? I think we should be careful to do so. And yet the point is this. Had Esther and Mordecai or their relatives before them returned home under Cyrus, well, the reality is those other Jews who had remained in Persia would be in great danger because of the plot that is about to be revealed in chapter 3. And Esther would never have been queen, and what would have been the plight of God's people then? It's no accident that Esther was living in Susa, and it's no accident that you are living where you do. Jeremiah told the people that while they were in exile, they should seek the welfare of that foreign land. And God's people in the New Testament are also called exiles, as we trust in Christ and we await for the kingdom of God to come and the heaven and the earth to be renewed. And in that time, while we live in this place, we should do everything we can as God's people to seek the welfare of the place we live. It's a challenging question, but I wonder how much would Dunstable miss the Christians of Dunstable Baptist Church if we weren't here. How much of a benefit and a welfare to the welfare of people living in this town are we actually being in our personal lives and as a church? It may be just that in the providence of God, we are living here in this place at this time, that he may use us for his saving plans and purposes of people in this town. We see the providence of God in the places we live. But secondly, we see the providence of God in the positions we hold. Verses 8 to 18. Now, in many Christian children's books, and rightly so, what follows is often presented as nothing more than a beauty pageant. And it is right to guard small children from particular details of what we read here in Esther. But we must not remain under any illusion that what took place was anything but an affront to God and an affront to every woman. Think about the contest for a moment, looking at verses 8 to 17 in particular. Who had put Esther in the contest? We're not actually told. We're certainly not given any idea that Esther put herself forward for this contest. Some have suggested Mordecai put her forward for this contest, but at closer reading, I'm not actually convinced about that. Because actually, when Esther is introduced, when the contest is proclaimed, look what we read. We read that when the king's order and his edicts were proclaimed, and when the young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in the custody of Haggai, Esther also was what? Taken into the king's palace. And if you just go back a little bit, it does seem that the author of Esther has been dropping some clues about how we should interpret that word taken. Because look what he said about Mordecai and Esther in verse 5 and 6. There was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jer, son of Shimei, son of Kish, the Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, with whom King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon had carried away. And it seems that Esther, just as the people of Israel were taken away, carried away from their homeland under a foreign king, so Esther is taken away from her adoptive father Mordecai, from the only place where she could express her Jewish identity at that time safely, and she is taken in to the foreign king's palace. It seems to me that Esther didn't have much choice. And where is she put? She's put in the harem with the other virgins who are now going to undergo a 12-month beauty program. 6 months of this, 6 months of that, and then you're going to face the king, and you're not going to have a conversation with him. And yet, just like some others before her, we read about how she has won the favour while she's there of the guy in charge, of Haggai, who has charge over them. So much so that he promotes her to the chief place in the harem. And can we just pause for a moment to notice something about Mordecai? Because I think it's becoming popular that we give Mordecai a bad rap, and I don't think we should. I've been convinced of this. Pause to notice what Mordecai does every single day. He goes and he checks on Esther. Esther chapter 1 and Esther chapter 2, we see again and again contrasts going on. And here we see another contrast. We see a king who has such a low view of women, who is not protected of them but discards them if they upset him, who wants them only for their beauty and nothing else, and his own pleasure. And then you have Mordecai, who takes in his cousin when her parents have died, when she's vulnerable. He doesn't discard her, he takes her in. And when she's taken from him into the harem, even then he doesn't forget about her. It doesn't take him 3 years to remember her. He goes every single day to check on her welfare. What a good man. And then, at the end of this contest, after the 12 months of beautifying and diet, not much has changed, has it? Progress. Finally, she is going to meet Ahasuerus. And in the morning, she's going to go back to a harem. Not the same harem, a different harem. Because her status has changed. She is not going to be a virgin, she's going to be a concubine. And then something happens. Something happens to Esther that changes everything. Just as she has won the favor of Haggai, and just as she has begun to win the favor of all who were seeing her, she somehow wins the favor of Ahasuerus. And he loves her more than all the other women. And he takes the vacant crown of Vashti and he places it upon her head, Esther's head. And to celebrate, another feast. They love their feast as the Persian kings. And this is a lavish feast. And he says, this is Esther's feast. And he invites his servants and all of his officials. And he wants the whole empire to join in so that he gives them a tax relief. And he gives them gifts. All of this showing that this king is a king who refuses to learn from his mistakes. A king who runs to his advisors, a king who can't make decisions for himself, a king who treats women shamefully, a king who just cannot help to lavishly feast and dine with others. He's a playboy king. He fails to listen to good advice. He listens to godless advice. He fails to value women, he demeans them, and he fails to live a content life but indulges in decadency. And at this point, we might just be asking, where's God in all of this? And what we do need to do is take notice of what we may call passive verbs. Passive verbs are simply this, that there are verbs there, but we're not sure how it's happening or who's doing it. So, for example, here is Esther taken into the harem. Who's taken her? We're not told. We're told Esther wins favour with Haggai. How does she win favour? We don't know. Does she actively seek to win favour? Unlikely. She doesn't only win favour with Haggai, but she wins favour with all the others, and then she wins favour with Ahasuerus. And again, we're not told about any way that she tried to do this. Everything that seems to have happened to her has seemingly been outside of her control and certainly outside of Mordecai's control. And yet nothing that has happened to her has been outside the control of her Lord and God. Because if we're reading the Bible and we know the stories of the Bible, the great and wonderful stories in the Old Testament, we know about others who won favour, don't we, when they were in unlikely positions. And at that time, the narrators were a little bit more explicit about how they won the favour. You remember Joseph. Peter took us through a series in Joseph. And here is Joseph, thrown away by his brothers, sold into slavery, ends up in a man called Potiphar's house. He's there as the head servant until a woman looks at him and desires him for herself and puts him in a compromising situation. And he is thrown into the prison. And while he's there in the prison, he wins favor. Everywhere he goes, he seems to win favor. He won the favor of Potiphar. He won the favor of the prison guards. He then wins the favor of Pharaoh. And all of this, we know from the story in Genesis and from the narrator of Genesis, was God helping him to win favor. And then we sit here about Daniel in exile also. And we read the book of Daniel and we see that in chapter 1, as a young man, he's taken into exile and he's put and he's being trained in the Babylonian culture. And there again, even though he refuses the king's food from the king's table and he refuses the king's wine, he wins favor. And it's God, it's very clear that it's God who's winning him favor. And here again, Esther, though God is not mentioned, God is with her. God is using her. God is giving her success in those very, very compromising situations. Because he is going to use her. He is going to use her position for his saving plans and purposes. And it should be great comfort to us that whatever position we find ourselves in, whatever circumstances, even when they seem out of control to us, any whatever circumstances we are in, it may be that God uses them for our good, for the good of others, and certainly for his own glory. Now, that doesn't mean that we should spend every moment of our days trying to work out how God is using this particular circumstance that's happening right now for our good and for his glory, because providence is not something we can read front to back. It's something we only read back to front. It's hindsight that allows us to say, this is how God was with me. And so take comfort if you're in situations you never would have asked for that seem outside of your control, outside of your power. Don't lose heart, because the testimony of others before you would say that in difficult situations, in circumstances they couldn't control, God was with them. And he's with you too. And when you're through it, you will know it. And you will remember it. And you'll see it. The positions we hold. But then lastly, we see God's providence in the people we meet. Esther isn't the only one who's been promoted. It appears Mordecai was promoted too. Verse 19, we find Mordecai sitting in the gate of the king. And this isn't a gate that the king just seems to walk in and out of, and it's like your garden gate. It has no significance whatsoever. No, the king's gate is a place of prominence. It's a place where business is done. It's a place where administration happens. It's a place where royal officials mingle and do that work of politics. That's the king's gate. And Mordecai is there. And it seems he has an official position already in the kingdom, probably by the influence of Esther. And while Mordecai is sat there, he overhears a plot. Verses 20 to 22. For the second time, the virgins have been gathered together. The virgin young women are gathered together following the coronation of the new queen, Esther. And why are they gathered a second time? Some suggest that the purpose of the second gathering was to send them home. I think that's a misreading of the text. It's more likely that this is another gathering in order for them to all be sent to be concubines of the king in the second harem. And it's while this is taking place that Mordecai, sitting in the gate, discovers a plot against the life of King Ahasuerus. And remember, Mordecai, he doesn't owe much to this king. He's a Jew living in exile, though he could have returned. He's under the power of a foreign king. He could have taken this opportunity to exalt Esther. A dead king, maybe that's an opportunity for Esther. But that's not what he does. Mordecai doesn't sit on the information, but immediately tells it to the freshly installed queen, Esther. The one person who knows about about the plot, just so happens to know the one person who can do something about it. And so Esther, receiving this information from Mordecai, takes the information to Ahasuerus, and he has the matter investigated. It's confirmed true. And the two men responsible are hanged, and the whole thing is recorded in official documents in front of King Ahasuerus. And yet something doesn't happen that should have happened. Something doesn't happen that was normal in the Persian kingdom. Mordecai is not celebrated. And that will become important. Perhaps it speaks of how at that time in that culture Jewish people were being looked upon. Hence Mordecai's suggestion to Esther, don't reveal your identity too soon. Keep it quiet. Use a different name. Mordecai saves the king's life, but is not celebrated for his actions, which was customary in the Persian world. You do something good, you get celebrated. They love a feast. But once again, we see here God's hidden hand in the story as he places the right people in the right place at the right time. Now, in the Open Air Mission, the evangelists often refer to people who they contact on the streets, not as contacts, but as divine appointments. I love that term, divine appointments, because it's a simple reminder that each meeting with every person is no coincidence, but it's been prearranged by the Lord. Who has the Lord put in your way recently? Who has the Lord put in your life that you might be an influence on, that you might be able to do good to, that you might even be used just for the saving of their souls as you point them to Christ? No one you meet, it's no accident. It's a divine appointment. Start seeing it like that and watch your evangelism change. In closing, how do you see the circumstances of your life? Perhaps you live in a place that seems to be increasingly godless and you feel powerless to change. Or maybe you hold a position in society where it feels like everyone makes the decision for you. You make no decision of your own. Or possibly there are people in your life who are doing things that concern you and cause you distress. Well, we should never despair. But like Esther, we should trust that the Lord will use it all for our own good. And if we doubt that, we must remember the cross. Jesus was in a place where people plotted against him to murder him. He was arrested. He was taken, like Esther, and delivered over to wicked and lawless hands, who would then not crown him, but crucify him. But what does Peter say? All of this happened according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, that Jesus might be crowned king and that you might be saved. Brothers and sisters, let's not walk by sight in this world as we live in our exile, but by faith in the sovereign and only eternal King of Kings, Jesus Christ. Amen.